At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking the economy this week, international students, China, and the so-called end of the 50% participation target. Again.
But don't underestimate how much time and effort is going into looking at how do you do socially distance teaching, how do you do socially distance student support, social activities. Universities will be offering a whole range of in-person activity, far, far beyond just some of the teaching. And so, yes, it'll be a different experience. But actually, if you compare it to the rest of people's lives and what people will be doing otherwise.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to help inject a bit of policy stimulus into this faltering economy, I have three amazing guests as ever. In London, we have Jess Drenk, Policy and Public Affairs Manager at Middlesex University, where I should also say I'm proud to be a governor. Jess, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I think my highlight has to be catching up with friends again at the weekend and watching our kids have a big water fight in the garden.
Also in London, and only streets away from Wonky's lockdown HQ, in fact, we have Alistair Jarvis, Chief Exec of Universities UK. Alistair, your highlight of the week.
Now that Jess has gone for a personal one, mine's going to sound very sad, but I thought the immigration reforms we've seen for international students over the last week or so and the fact the government's committed to further reforms with the new Office for Talent is going to be really good for universities. But I now wish I'd gone for a personal one.
Always on message. And from Team Wonky, it's our very own editor, Debbie McVitty. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I'm gonna follow Alistair's lead. My highlight of this week has been our Black Lives Matter event, which we had yesterday. And despite some initial technical issues with getting the enormous number of people who expressed interest to be able to get onto the Zoom call, it was inspirational, it was challenging, and I really, really hope it's going to lead to some really significant change.
It was spectacular, and you can watch it back. You can watch the whole event back on YouTube, which we've put on wonky.com. Right, let's start with the economy. The Chancellor got to his feet yesterday in Parliament and set out a bunch of measures around skills and training and getting the country moving again. Universities didn't get a huge amount of mention, but lots of measures, possibly with an indirect link to the sector. Alistair, talk us through this.
Thanks, Mark. So, I mean, it's very clear that the government is focused primarily on the economy at the moment. They're very worried about what the state of the economy with COVID-19 and what the economic recovery looks like. Although this isn't all completely new. If you go back to the 2019 Conservative Manifesto, the December general election manifesto, there is lots in that about focusing on skills, focusing on particularly vocational routes, the weakness of vocational education routes and the need to improve that, the focus on level 3s, 4, 5. So I think we're starting to see now the government actually pushing forward the policy agenda that they've wanted to progress for a while, that was sort of paused, slowed down because of COVID-19. And if anything, they're saying that this is even more important now, given the need to drive the economic recovery. So I think that's sort of where we are. And that was why we saw a strong focus on skills. And I think very much linked to that is jobs. So the reason they want to see a focus on skills and more people developing their skills is A, because they think businesses need it, and B, because they want people to get jobs.
For me, the one of the positive things in the announcements this week were around apprenticeships. So it was really great to see new payments to employers for each new apprenticeship they hire, both under 25 and over 25-year-olds. Really great to see that there's no distinction being made there between the levels of apprenticeship. I think what for me is really important is that all levels of apprenticeships are being enabled to play their full role in the recovery from the pandemic, because I think apprenticeships have got a really critical role to play there in terms of social mobility, or dare I say it, levelling up. We're certainly seeing that in the higher and degree apprenticeships at Middlesex, where we have really high numbers of mature learners and apprentices from BAME groups coming through. So great to see that this week, and it would be good to see more really, so that apprenticeships can play their full role in the government's agendas.
So I completely agree with Jess, and I think that there's loads of potential to continue to grow apprenticeships, all different levels. I think there's huge demand from employers, particularly for degree apprenticeships, and huge demand from people to do them. But I'm really worried about whether the money's there. I mean, we've gone for a time when the apprenticeship levy pot seemed to be very full and the government was driving an increase, to a time when they're running out of money there. There isn't the money for apprenticeships that there used to be. And I think we're going to see demand outstrip supply because there isn't enough money to fund them. And that's really worrying. And I think the government needs to act to make sure that they can support those people wanting to go and do apprenticeships, and I said particularly the very popular degree apprenticeships.
It doesn't seem clear where they want people to do apprenticeships, though, does it? I mean, they're talking a lot about investing in level 3, 4, and 5, but further education colleges are in, you know, much worse trouble than universities are financially, and they don't seem to appreciate that a lot of this stuff can actually happen inside higher education in some form.
Yeah, absolutely. I strongly believe that there is still a strong economic case to get more people to university, expand the number of people studying at higher levels, and that the economy benefits from that and individuals benefit from that. But it doesn't actually mean they necessarily do the same things as they're doing now. And I think you know, if we're going to see a growth in people studying at high levels, that should be through courses in partnership with business, degree apprenticeships, part-time, mature people retraining, reskilling, all the kind of things that are really going to help the economy. But universities can do this stuff, and the universities are doing this and can expand this further. Shrinking universities or restricting that is not the way to do it.
Yeah, Debbie, it doesn't seem like universities are central to that narrative, despite clearly being important players.
Yes, and I think that's fair. But then I also think that it's good policy not to kind of decide out of the gate, you know, exactly how you're going to deliver on your target. So I think, you know, I think there's probably an onus here on universities to step up to the plate and to demonstrate kind of how they're going to deliver and how they're going to kind of support those aims in kind of skilling up and increasing the numbers of people doing those apprenticeships. I think perhaps a missing group that wasn't mentioned yesterday is graduates, and I think we should still be a bit concerned about graduate jobs and about graduate employability this year. Certainly we know that there may be employers who are reducing the number of graduates that they take on. It will certainly be difficult for graduates to find bridging work as they look for their long-term career choices. So, but I think the other thing to say is that anyone who's kind of thinking that universities haven't got a look in this summer statement. So I mean, so it, you know, there is universities are absolutely central to the economic growth. And that's particularly focused on science. And I think there's absolutely space to play in across the rest of it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's lots of things incorrectly written about how universities haven't had support through COVID-19 from government, and they have. I mean, you look at quite a lot of measures to boost international competitiveness through immigration reform. You look at this 2.4 billion package of support for research and innovation, a mixture of grants and loans. There's clearly a government view that, despite maybe not promoting a growth in universities and looking at strengthening some other weaker areas of education, they absolutely don't want universities to fail. And you know, there are a number of interventions in place to make sure that universities are not severely damaged because of COVID-19. And I think actually that goes back to the earlier point that somebody made about the kind of place focus. And that as much as this government, universities may not be flavour of the month for this government, and they may not be promoting them, supporting them the same as you're hearing them talk about some other areas like the NHS and other areas, they also completely understand that if you want to have successful towns and cities and you want to have wealth and you want to support those communities, universities are really crucial. So I think although they may not be actively promoting and trying to grow them, I think also they're very wary of damaging universities because they're so crucial to their local place.
Yeah, just on that, on the role of universities and their places, I think it just makes me think again in the context of the debates this week and last about how important it is that universities are engaging the people in their constituencies, the people in their local area in what they do. And it's a point that we've heard Rachel Wolfe, who wrote the Tory Manifesto, and Matt Chorley from The Times make frequently, that we really need people to care about their local university and see the tangible impact that it has on them and their families' lives, so that universities rise up the political agenda and that we're seeing universities become more important in policy making and the resource that government is committing to the sector. The other thing I'd add is that I think it's really important that the government is harnessing the whole sector's contribution in recovery from the pandemic. So I think what we're seeing, which is quite worrying for some of the less affluent parts of the sector at the moment, is that the various support packages around student number controls, around research and the government's roadmap for research ongoing, are very focused on the quote unquote best universities, the more affluent parts of the sector. And I think if we're going to get through this pandemic, we really need to make sure that the whole sector is being supported and being enabled and harnessed to get us through this. And more importantly, the students in the less affluent parts of the sector are being enabled to play their part in the recovery, because those students have the skills and the resilience that the country needs to get through this. And I think the fact that some parts of the sector are being excluded or not supported as much as they might be, it is very disappointing in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Jess that we've got to make sure that the support reaches all those universities that need it, and that needs to be the diversity of the sector. I mean, part of that is looking at where the greatest losses are and therefore the greatest damage is, and making sure that the support protects those areas, the crucial work that all universities are doing in different ways, and so of course the impact of COVID-19 on university finances is not evenly felt across the sector, and therefore the support package is not going to be even, and that's fair enough, but it certainly shouldn't support one kind of university or one sort of mission over another. I mean, I just wanted to pick up on the point about universities' kind of civic local contribution. I mean, I entirely agree, and I was part of the Civic University Commission, that I think universities need to redouble their efforts, really have strong impact on their local communities. And I mean, for me, it's sort of saying that, you know, there's the classic kind of, well, universities do teaching and the education side, and they do research and innovation. But for me, it's absolutely the third bit, which is their civic impact, how they support local businesses, how they work with local schools, how they provide services and support local communities. For me, I think that should be in every university's list of sort of three priorities. You know, if it's education, if it's research and innovation, then the third bit should absolutely be that civic impact. And I think if we're going to continue to enjoy public support and continue to have people who want to go to university and work with universities, that civic side of what they do is just crucial.
And Debbie, it seems even more important now, doesn't it? Because many university towns are facing a kind of double whammy economic effect. Without, they haven't had students in the towns supporting the economy, and often universities are the largest employer. So does it give us more impetus for that agenda?
Yes, our friends at Tortoise modelled this, didn't they? And they find that university towns are struggling particularly, although I imagine, you know, coastal towns and other sort of more deprived areas are struggling too. Yes, I think in short, it's probably fair to say that. I think you know, as we emerge from coronavirus, and of course nobody knows how long that will take and what the process will be and when people will feel safe, you know, there will be a moment to look again. You know, if universities have been developing civic agreements, or if they've been working on developing those, to kind of look again and reassess where the patterns of need have shifted, and then recalibrate activity accordingly, and I guess come to a sort of new compact with their communities, and you know, really focused on moving us all on from this unpleasant state that we find ourselves in.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
My name is Paula Sussex, and I'm the Chief Executive of the Student Loans Company. I've written about what SLC has been doing to deliver reliable and timely finance to students and providers during the COVID-19 pandemic. In short, we've had to ensure that we can process 2 million applications and pay some 20 billion to students and the sector, all the while with our staff working remotely. We've had to grapple with the uncertainty of applicant behaviour, and we've had to adapt to meet the needs of the sector through the reprofiling of tuition fee payments. This will undoubtedly continue to be a challenging year, and we remain cautious, but also optimistic. Right now, with application volumes on a par with last year, it does feel like SLC has the stable foundation to continue to deliver, even in the face of a significant national emergency. And the whole team here at SLC are determined to do just that.
Okay, lots of interesting stuff happening around international students this week. We've had a report from UCSISA, big changes in the US, and HEPIs enter the debate about UK universities and its relationship with China. Jess, what's jumping out for you here?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So as you said, a really interesting report from UCSISA around making the UK more attractive, or the most attractive global destination for international students. So they're calling for changes to the visa system to prioritise international student visa applications, and an extension, interestingly, of the transition period for students from the European Economic Area. I think the theme around international students' experience jumped out at me with this report and the HEPI report on China, which I'll come to shortly. So UCSISA are calling for the development of a charter, an international students' charter, which celebrates best practice on supporting international students in the sector. And also just how important it is that there's a really clear and consistent message of welcome from the UK government to international students. So really recognising their positive contribution to society and the economy here. And so moving on to this new collection of essays on UK universities and China from HEPI. It covers a range of topics, UK-China scientific research, for example, and again, quite a big focus on student experience for Chinese students. And I was interested to read about the sense among Chinese students that it's really difficult for them to engage with UK students when they're at universities in the UK, and also to meet other international students. So there's an interesting challenge for the sector there. And also, there were some interesting thoughts around the tendency to make assumptions about Chinese students in UK universities, that we're perhaps falling back on stereotypes around how Chinese students learn, and a bit of a challenge to the sector to look in a more subtle way at the experiences and backgrounds and the diversity of students from China, and not just as a single entity. And then finally, as you said, Mark, we've got the news from the States that Harvard and MIT are suing Trump for stripping foreign students of their visas if classes move online in during the pandemic. So lots to digest there. And as I said, I think for me, that message around international students and how we can ensure that we're meeting their needs, and more importantly, getting them involved in the university beyond just the group that they arrive with. At Middlesex, interestingly, we've actually got an international student as our incoming students' union president at the moment. So I think there's something around how can we get those students engaged in the student voice in our universities and make sure that they're really embedded in the infrastructure of the university.
Well, there's lots there. We'll start with the US, Alistair. I mean, it seems like the Trump administration is having a terrible pandemic and has really blown it on international students, which should be good for the UK's ability to pick up some that might have otherwise gone. But you know, you've had strong words for the UK government and its handling of international student visas over the past. How far away would we be from you know, Oxford and Cambridge joining a lawsuit against the UK government to stop its ridiculous higher education immigration?
Well, I mean, first, I'm delighted to say that this is one of the areas where I think we're working kind of with government, and a lot of the views of the sector on how the immigration regime should change to better support international students is happening. So there's significant visa liberalisation. There's a commitment to reform the visa regime further. We set out principles last year about how that should happen, and the new Office for Talent has basically picked them up and is looking at how the new point-based system can be a lot faster, smoother, more efficient. So actually, I really can only be supportive of the direction of travel of the government's immigration policy for international students at this time. And I think we're seeing, actually, particularly through the pandemic, a lot more help and flexibility, post-study work visas and other things. So that's really good. And actually, if you talk about the comparison to the US, I mean, what an amazing own goal for Trump and his administration, and I mean, how damaging for their universities to take the position they're taking. I mean, it's incredible, really, isn't it? I mean, talk about self-inflicted damage. It will be bad for those universities, bad for their economy. And I mean, I you know, in solidarity with the universities in America, I hope that they win their lawsuit. But in terms of benefit from the UK higher education, clearly we are opening and welcoming to international students. We can offer them a good experience, and I would imagine a number of them won't wait to see the outcome of the lawsuit and will probably look elsewhere. So I think we may well benefit, but I don't want to sort of, I mean, I would certainly welcome those students here, but I don't want to sort of prey on the US universities, who I feel really quite sorry for and hope they win their case.
Mm-hmm. And China, why do you think China's rising up the agenda so much politically now?
Well, China is the great growing world power, whether that's economically, whether that's militarily, indeed actually in science and research and innovation and a lot of other areas as well. So it's kind of, you know, if you look at the 50 years ahead, our big global strategic diplomatic challenges, economic challenges are all likely to have a strong link to China. And I think we're just seeing playing out a growing power that's exerting its influence across the world and then therefore for causing challenges. And I think, you know, the UK and indeed the UK university sector is trying to adapt to this as much as everybody else. And I mean, for me, what we need to do is continue to have a positive relationship with China, continue to work with their universities, attract their students, work with them on research. But when you have a positive relationship with someone, you also should be open to challenge and criticize and disagree as well. So it's getting that balance between being supportive of China, working with China, but that doesn't mean not being critical when it's fair to do so.
There's a particular problem, though, isn't there, with this government, because the China hawks are clearly winning the argument. We've seen that over a number of things recently, particularly Hong Kong and probable climb down on the Huawei front and asking Huawei to remove its infrastructure from telecommunications. Are you worried that a version of this government could kind of one day turn around to universities and say, look, you're too reliant on recruiting Chinese students. We think that's now a kind of economic and political threat, and we're going to start putting measures in place to dial that down in a way that we expect them to start doing that in other parts of the economy, like telecommunications.
So I doubt that this government would try and, you know, block Chinese students from coming to the UK, and I think they understand their economic importance, but also the fact that the relationships with international students is part of what will help us develop long-term good trading, business, diplomatic relationships with China. Indeed, the more Chinese students that have a experience in the UK, the more likely that relationship will be positive in the future. So I don't think the government is in the mood to sort of try and stop that. I think what they are trying to do, as universities are, is to diversify the international student population more. And I mean, my view is yes, we are as a sector over-reliant on Chinese students. And that's not to say there's too many Chinese students. I think there just aren't enough from some other countries. And so we should be looking to the future as we grow our international student numbers, which is looking like it will happen. This is obviously going to be a tough year with the pandemic, but I'm still confident that the UK's sort of offer is strong and we will grow international student numbers in the medium term, particularly if we get the continued direction of travel on visas. So I think we just need to make sure that as we grow the numbers, we start to get a greater diversity in other countries. So we're not so reliant on Chinese students. But that shouldn't mean reducing the numbers. It should mean growing others.
I think we're at quite an interesting sort of pivotal point in some ways in the internationalization university agenda, because of course we've got Brexit. We've got this sort of urge towards figuring out what being a global Britain looks like. And we've got coronavirus, and we've got these kind of mounting tensions with China. And I think that speaks to me of a real opportunity, I think. I mean, I think this came through in some of the HEPI essays as well, about really understanding the countries and cultures that students are coming from and that universities are engaged with. And I think, you know, I think there's, you know, enormous depth of knowledge and insight within UK universities. And I think that there's maybe an opportunity to disseminate some of that more widely, you know, specifically because, you know, the global geopolitical settlement is much tenser these days than it was maybe a decade ago. And there are kind of real challenges with what international engagement looks like. And to kind of bring some of that insight to bear and to apply it, you know, from sort of that deep academic knowledge, to apply it not only to university internationalization activities and choices and strategies, but also to the kind of to the public discourse, I think can only benefit how the UK moves forward.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, you know, if you look at our our future diplomatic influence around the world and our economic and trading links and other things, the better understanding we have of other countries and cultures, the better. And yes, I think we are. I mean, I think, you know, how do we make Britain truly global following Brexit? Well, it is building that better understanding, surely, of other countries and cultures. So I agree. And I mean, that's the great thing about universities, because that's kind of our bread and butter. That's what we do. That's why it's so important that we have international universities that have those global links and have significant numbers of international students and staff. You know, on a positive note in this area, we are seeing a significant growth in interested in Indian students coming to the UK. So, I mean, if you look at where there is potential to grow really big strategic partnerships with universities overseas, getting, you know, research partnerships, getting mobile international students, I think India is is clearly great potential, and we're seeing a growth there. We've got a report coming out soon called "Why Aren't We Second?" and it looks at where there are countries around the world where the UK isn't in the top two in terms of choices for their international students, and why that is the case, why we're not, and what we can do about it. So that's very much an effort to diversify and grow numbers from different countries.
And that I think that segmented approach is going to be really important. You know, I think we probably, where this is happening, we can't just be talking about, you know, international students as this kind of lumped together bunch of undifferentiated, you know, people. They're all coming from specific cultures and contexts. And I think if there is a challenge with engaging with UK students, that's something that really needs to be looked at in terms of kind of developing intercultural competencies. And again, not as a generic thing, but a sort of a deep understanding of the specifics of other people's cultures. You know, we could all probably deal with a bit more of that.
Absolutely. I really agree with that. And I think it's just really important that we're not perceived as being entirely self-serving in our international education strategy, and that we're not just seeing those international students as cash cows, that we develop that more subtle way of engaging with those students' needs.
Entirely agree. I think surely a big part of the international education strategy has got to be the experience we're offering international students, because we've got to ultimately look at the fact, you know, why do international students want to come here? And that's because we're offering them something which is of value to them. And if we don't focus on that, we're going to really suffer. So absolutely, that's sort of, frankly, the starting point's got to be, how do you make it as good experience as possible, and how do you understand the differences?
Hmm. Right, this is a perfect time to bring in, to do Yes, But Does It Correlate? Because it's on an international theme.
Welcome, bienvenue, willkommen, kreuzo, and eyup to a special internationally focused edition of Yes, But Does It Correlate? The world-leading podcast segment in a good way. For OECD countries, I plotted the 2018 GDP per capita, which is indexed to 2010, against the calculated percentage of people under 25 who will enter a bachelor's level degree at some point during their lifetime. The question this week was suggested by Rachel Wolfe of Public First. Thank you, Rachel. So, is there a link between access to HE and GDP? Does it correlate?
But yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem feasible that it doesn't correlate, does it?
I would also say yes.
The answer is no. There is no significant correlation between these measures. However, the graph itself is well worth a look. The UK, coloured in pale orange, is slightly above average on entry rates and pretty much on the median for GDP growth since 2010. Quite close to Germany. The only OECD countries with a lower entry rate and a larger positive change in GDP are Estonia and Turkey. Data is from the excellent OECD statistics resource, and where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
Now, we've had the latest UCAS figures out this week. Debbie, talk us through them.
Right. So the latest data release for the 30th of June deadline from UCAS should give a reasonable amount of comfort to the sector, who obviously everyone's sort of poised, wondering what's going to happen in September. So 4 out of 10 18-year-olds had applied to a higher education course before the main deadline, compared to last year, starting from the 23rd of March, which is when the Prime Minister announced lockdown on the 30th of June, we've seen 17% more new applications. So that seems really positive. And there's been a particular increase in nursing applications, particularly, which I think shows the kind of the effect of the COVID-19 bump and the kind of heroic efforts of NHS staff in the front line. So there's clearly students have been inspired by that. And there's some really interesting analysis from UCAS on the site today, which explores, you know, what's actually going on with some of these late applicants. And one of the things, so particularly among mature applicants, so you're talking about, you know, people who've maybe got kids at home, who've maybe been put on furlough, or who, you know, who feel like their jobs might be at risk, you know, have had actually, because of COVID-19, some time to think about what they want from life and what their opportunities are and what might be available to them. And one of the things that they're doing is applying for higher education courses. So this is incredibly positive. But of course, DK signs a note of caution on his write-up of the numbers, which points out that, of course, we've still got quite a long way to go between now and September, and universities are working incredibly hard to work out what that offer will look like.
Yeah, I'd jump in there if that's okay. I thought this was really great to see. I think the story around health programmes certainly matches up with what we're seeing at Middlesex. We're seeing a lot of interest in our health programmes, particularly nursing. And it's great to see that. I think all the inspirational stories from health workers. I mean, we've had 500 of our nurses on the front line during the pandemic, and I think those inspirational stories of the role health workers are playing and have played in the pandemic are really having an impact. I'd say a word of caution around the expansion in places for health programs are really welcome, but we've seen that there are limits to how far that expansion can go, because you need the placements to match with those programs to be able to expand substantially. I think mature learners data is really interesting as well. I think, as you say, Debbie, it could well be that more blended style of learning is more appealing for mature learners as they juggle the pressures they may have in their personal lives. I mean, many of our students have care commitments, they work part-time. If they were coming to campus, they'd have long and complex and expensive commutes. So it could be that this sort of enforced pilot of blended learning will play a big role in the new normal that we see after evolving after the pandemic.
Mm. Alistair, go on.
It's great. Yeah, I mean, it's great news to see that, you know, despite the pandemic, that I think, you know, a lot of people feared that it would see people turning away from university or concerned about what universities will be offering in the autumn. But it's very clear that people are voting with their feet and deciding to go to university, and they still see that as the route to a better life and a better job and to fulfil their ambitions. And I mean, I think this is why, you know, government and others need to be careful about anything that effectively caps aspiration or suggests to people that they shouldn't be going to university. And I'm worried with some of the rhetoric you hear in this area, because clearly the vast majority of people that go to university benefit significantly from that experience, you know, whether that be jobs, whether that be life opportunities, whether that be their family. And people want to go to university, and the numbers are showing that. So I think, you know, we're seeing a growth this year, and I expect to see continued growth and people want to go into university as a route to a sort of better life.
Also, though, I would add, there's lots of positive here, but I think we need to be a little bit cautious in our optimism, because we do need to see these applications converting to enrolment in the autumn. And I think for mature learners, there's always a chance that applying for university is one of many sort of options many irons in the fire that they've put in place so that they can see how things stand in the autumn. And I think also for disadvantaged learners, what we see at Middlesex is just how important it is that we're working with those applicants through things like pre-induction programs, communicating with them regularly, managing that transition, reassuring them, helping them build networks so that they that they do continue and enrol in the autumn. That's particularly important for disadvantaged learners and is going to be more important than ever in the current climate. And the final thing I'd say around being cautiously optimistic is the UCAS approach this year, which is actively encouraging students to self-release and look at trading up. And I think we can be clear that there'll be winners and losers from that approach this year.
I think also we shouldn't underestimate the scale of the task facing universities here as well, because I mean, there's a really good piece on the site by Jim this morning, kind of exploring what, you know, if you're going to offer some kind of face-to-face experience, what should that be? And is it the right thing to focus purely on learning and teaching, actually? Because the thing that students may miss in September, and that will be really, really challenging for universities to deal with, is that sense of community and particularly access to resources. So Jim's arguing that there might, you know, that there's a case for delivering high quality, you know, focusing your teaching online, delivering that at a very high quality rather than trying to split your attention between kind of the room and the internet, and actually opening up things like computer labs, you know, study space, you know, opportunities for students to kind of congregate in a socially distanced and kind of managed way. And of course, it's, you know, it's a classic, Jim. It's a very challenging piece, but I think there's, you know, as universities continue to think about September, thinking about that, you know, as and when the students do show up, you know, will they be able to get everything that they need from that experience? And that is a genuinely challenging proposition, I think, for universities.
So I completely agree with the caution about numbers, and that there's of course a risk that people change their mind late on. But at the moment, I think people are really underestimating how much universities will be offering in person. Yeah, the experience will be different, and of course our lives are different. We're having to adapt to socially distanced activities across, you know, all parts of our life, and of course universities have to do that as well. But don't underestimate how much time and effort is going into looking at how do you do socially distanced teaching, how do you do socially distanced student support, social activities. Universities will be offering a whole range of in-person activity, far, far beyond just some of the teaching. And so, yes, it'll be a different experience. But actually, if you compare it to the rest of people's lives and what people will be doing otherwise, at university, you're going to get about as fuller experience under social distancing measures as you will do in any other sort of part of life. So I don't think that, you know, people should look at universities and think, oh, my goodness, just because it's not the same as last year, it's going to be much worse than any of the other options, because actually everything is going to be socially distanced. And I think universities are actually quite a long way ahead in what they are able to offer and deliver than some other areas.
And finally, the Secretary of State, Gavin Williamson, has been giving a major set-piece speech about tertiary education today. It's later in the day. Alistair and Jess have gone on to get on with their day jobs. But I'm here with Debbie to review the speech and talk about its implications. Before we do, let's hear a little bit.
I don't accept this absurd mantra that if you're not part of a 50% of young people who go to university, that you've somehow come up short. You have become one of a forgotten 50% who choose another path. It exasperates me that there is still an inbuilt snobbishness about higher being somehow better than further, when really they're both just different paths to fulfilling and skilled employment. Especially when the evidence demonstrates that further education can open the doors to greater opportunity, better prospects, and transform lives. We must never forget that the purpose of education is to give people the skills they need to get a good and meaningful job.
So that was Gavin Williamson talking, Secretary of State for Education, of course. Debbie, what were your first impressions about this speech?
One of the interesting things about this speech is the spin of it. So fundamentally, this is a speech about the necessity of investing and supporting the 50% of young people who currently do not go into higher education. This is something that we've been hearing about, I mean, certainly since the days of Ed Miliband, and before that, because obviously for, you know, a century or more, we've been wanting to invest and improve technical education. So that's fundamentally what the speech is about, and that I think is a very credible policy agenda and something that, you know, we've been expecting. What the speech was billed as was about ending the 50% target of young people's participation in higher education. Of course, a target that was formally met some years ago, but hasn't really been in existence for longer than that. So there's, I think, a question about exactly what Gavin Williamson's trying to do here. So let's start with the policy. I think it's probably the right policy to invest in FE. I think it's widely understood that there is a lack of meaningful alternatives for people who don't want to go to university, or for whom that's not the right choice right now at the kind of point of leaving school or college, or don't want a full degree, or whatever that is. And the role of colleges as placemakers in local areas is, I think, you know, as the Secretary of State said, is under-recognised, and that's all really important. In some ways, I think, what was expected was something kind of scarier for the university sector, so perhaps more of a kind of narrative about rebalancing, about, you know, some of the things that we heard from Michelle Donlan last week about low value degrees and grade inflation. And the fact that wasn't in there, I think, is really positive. And in some ways, what's helpful is although you know, there's this focus on 50% on the ending of the 50% target and the implication that, you know, too many people are going to university, there's not actually a policy agenda in the speech that suggests that people should be restricted from going to university if that's what they want to do. And certainly the emphasis on the higher technical, the level 4 and 5 provision, which of course universities deliver as well as colleges, is an agenda that supports the progression of all kinds of people into university in potentially a positive way. I think it would be really problematic if the government said, oh, well, we need to actively restrict people going to university and making the choices that are right for them, because inevitably that would hit the most disadvantaged. We're not going to stop middle-class people going to university because that aspiration is always going to be there, whereas obviously the path into university is going to be more complex if you come from a less advantaged background. So in some, it is a what appears to be a kind of pretty solid policy agenda spun in a way that's incomprehensible to a lot of observers in universities, but probably makes a lot of sense to a handful of Tory backbenchers.
Yeah, and I mean, a few things that were interesting for me as well, because the it's as you said, it was billed as something that's going to be a lot more scary for universities than it actually was, but very much an extension of the government's agenda. Now back 3 or 4 years at the very least, you know, you take a lot of what was said today. Looks very close to what Damien Hines, Gavin Williamson's predecessor, said in December 2018. Looks very close to a lot of the things said around the org review, the commission of it, and the kind of the immediate aftermath. So in some ways, almost feels like a kind of normalizing. I guess from our point of view inside higher education is the importance of trying to contextualize this and understand and what Gavin Williamson means when he says he's looking out for the golden 50%. Now, I think. Really good that he doesn't then also say in the speech universities are terrible, which Michelle Donnellan found 16 Orwellian ways of saying in her speech last week. So that's really positive. But what is he actually trying to accomplish with this policy when it comes to, or this agenda when it comes to higher education? And it seems to me a kind of more subtle reading of it is not a shrinking of higher education. It's a possible expansion of level 4 and 5 qualifications delivered at university, so kind of technical qualifications and those sorts of things. It's possible that he sees a role for a big chunk of the sector in a lot of that, perhaps in collaboration with further education, but definitely kind of a role for HE. And let's not forget the 50% so-called target includes level 4 and 5. So I think what he's talking about is, or just really raising the question, is full-time bachelor's, residential, undergraduate degree on a boarding school model, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is that the best value for money for taxpayers? And there's a genuinely legitimate debate about that and whether it's the best value for taxpayers, the right thing for students, genuinely legitimate debate to be had about that without attacking universities. I guess what's pleasing and almost surprising is we got a little bit of that today without the usual attack line. So I'd say that was pretty good news.
Yeah, I mean, this is of course our first take, and we're going to be digesting it a bit more on the site over the weekend, and you know, look out for our Monday briefing to get our full take. I mean, one thing that did jump out at me and was the claim that someone who's taken a higher technical apprenticeship after 5 years earns more than the average graduate. And I think I would really like to dig into the data behind that claim, because I'm pretty sure that higher technical apprenticeships are not spread evenly across subject areas, for example. And I think that if you were to compare sector with sector, you might get a slightly different outcome if you were to run those numbers. So I think there's still some questionable assumptions in there, and I think there's some work that the DK will be doing around looking at skills versus salary, because I think it's not, you know, it's rarely as straightforward to say, oh well, you know, if you do an apprenticeship or a higher technical qualification, you too could get the salary of your dreams, and you know, that is not true, but it's not always true either. And fundamentally, I think, yeah, no, young people should have plenty of choice, and salary may be one aspect of that, but ultimately one of the things we know about higher education and degrees is that they prepare you for lifelong learning, and they prepare you for all kinds of careers, you know, as Gavin Williamson puts it, the jobs that don't yet exist. So we do need to be really confident that what's being offered at level 4 and 5 does that too, and doesn't just prepare you for a job that's here right now but that may disappear in 5 years' time.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you listen to your podcasts, or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on a Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Jess, Alistair, Debbie and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.